May it please the court, my name is Jason Quickley. I represent the plaintiff appellant, R.W. Docks and Slips. Sitting behind me is Robert Holmgren. He's the managing agent for R.W. Docks. The matter before the court now, I believe, is essentially a summary judgment case. The primary question is whether the trial court made improper factual findings at that stage of the proceedings, and whether the trial court followed the proper legal standards. The factual findings that the court made was that there was no recognizable property interest in 71 Slips. That factual finding is not something that it should have been able to do at that stage of the proceedings, because of factual inferences and affidavits and facts on record that would have precluded the court from making that finding. The other issue that the trial court decided on summary judgment was that there was no evidence showing adverse economic impact to R.W. Docks, in that they had not lost any property value because they were able to develop 201 of the 272 slips. Again, there's factual evidence on record that, in fact, there was a loss of over $1 million, and the remaining 71 slips had an economic value of $1.5 million. With those findings on the record, and there being no other contrary findings, it was simply inappropriate at a summary judgment proceeding for the trial court to decide in a contrary fashion. The other question regarding summary judgment is whether the trial court followed the proper legal standards. And the proper legal standards in a taking case are to decide first, has there been a physical invasion of property? Lucas and Palazzolo describe this type of invasion as a categorical or per se takings case. That is, when the government actually takes physical occupancy of the land. The other type of a categorical or per se taking is when there's a total deprivation of all economic value as a result of a regulation. If the court does not conclude that there's a physical invasion or a deprivation of all economic use of the property, that does not preclude there from being a takings. The legal standard is that once the court has decided that it is not a total deprivation of all practical use of the property, it also needs to look at whether the property will be analyzed as a whole or as individual parcels.
Okay, I have a question, and not on the trial judge, Judge Gallagher's ruling, but just is you're maintaining that you have a property interest. Judge Gallagher indicated in his ruling that there was no property interest in Lake Superior's bed or waters, and, you know, just under the public trust doctrine. How do you establish a property interest in that aspect as far as the bed of Lake Superior?
The property interest is derived, one, from the rights of a riparian property owner, and those are established in Chapter 30. And it is a qualified right, admittedly, but it is a right nonetheless. The other area in which there is a property right is that in 1977, there was a condominium complex established and recorded in the Bayfield County Register of Deeds, which set forth 272 condominium units, which were placed on the surface of the lake, and an undivided interest in the on-land infrastructure, the breakwater, the quay, the lagoon.
But that's dealing with private interest and private interest. What I'm maybe I misunderstood your answer, but you're saying that a riparian owner would have a property interest in the waters or the bed of a, whether it's a stream or a lake, what I'm indicating is that's held in public trust. So how do you get a, I can see the riparian owner's rights on the, let's say, on the land itself, but I have difficulty with the, that ownership or property rights extending to the bed of the stream, or the, in this case, Lake Superior.
I guess, Your Honor, the answer to that question is that the riparian rights do extend to the right to build a wharf or a pier or a dock in order to access navigable waters. And that right is subject to state regulation. And the fact that there is a public trust doctrine out there is what enables the state to exercise its police power and regulate. But it doesn't preclude there from being a property interest completely. It's what gives the state the right to actually require permits and to give or deny those permits. It's the same as in, for example, the Eberle case, when they rezoned their land as they did. When they acquired title to their land, they did not have a right to build a driveway. The right to build a driveway was not part of their interest in that property when they bought it. It was subject to regulations based upon zoning. Similarly, RW Docks has a right, riparian right, and it's subject to regulations which are made effective pursuant to the public trust doctrine.
Would your position be different if you had applied, and I know you've been doing this, this has been going on for, I believe, 31 years since 1968, starting in 69, but this was sort of an incremental process. Obviously, it's a big process of having to dredge and build and et cetera. But like in, you had 271. What if you wanted, you ended up, asked for 271 and you got, in this case, 201, all right? And you're saying that to be fully, fully vested in your property right, you would have to have the 271. There could be none less.
I believe that's...
Isn't that an incremental decision from the DNR as far as each time we put in an application?
I don't believe it is in this particular case, Your Honor, and here's why. If the DNR had initially said you cannot build a marina that's going to be larger than 201 slips, that would be fine. RW Docks would not have invested in all the infrastructure that it did for 272 slips. But what RW Docks said in 1968 was, I'm going to build this marina. Here's our plans for it. It's going to consist of this breakwater large enough to shelter six docks. It's going to consist of all this infrastructure. It's going to have this number of piers. And the Army Corps of Engineers and the DNR gave it the go-ahead.
Can you rely on that?
Absolutely.
Did they give it the go-ahead, Council? As I recall the record, they gave it a partial go-ahead. There were permits granted for incremental parts of the construction.
That's correct. It was the permits for the dredging were granted incrementally, but the permit for the breakwater itself, which was necessary because you cannot build a breakwater on an incremental basis, and you cannot build a lagoon and a quay and these types of things on an incremental basis, were all granted initially. So from the outset, all of the infrastructure was for a marina of the contemplated size, 272 slips.
Okay, can you tell me, now I'm beginning to understand what it is your argument is. Can you tell me what it is that was done at the outset, for which permits were granted, that were done in contemplation of this entire of 271 slips or whatever, how many there were?
I can answer your question. And
you've identified one, the breakwater.
Before doing that, I'd just like to reiterate my point that that is one of the factual questions that I believe require remand, in that the trial court never explored this area. But the affidavits and Bob Holmgren's evidence is that he talked with the DNR and the Army Corps of Engineers. He had a plan, which is in the appendix to our brief, that showed the layout of the breakwater, the 272 slips, the lagoon, the quay, and all the on-land infrastructure. That was initially known from 1968. And yes, to answer your previous question, the dredging permits were granted incrementally, but all the other stuff was known from the very beginning.
Like what?
The size of the breakwater, the number of slips, the location of the slips. The one change happened in 1977 with this dispute over the quay.
Well, Council, let me come at it a different way. It seems to me that your argument is based somewhat upon a reasonable expectation of RW Ducks, that the action of the DNR in granting certain stages of this development was enough to create a reasonable expectation within the minds of RW Docks so that the denial down the road was a taking. So far as I can hear, you have only told me of one part of that construction in which that you could make that argument, and that's the breakwater, because the breakwater, you can't just do a break. I understand that. The breakwater has to be big and completed all at once. Is there anything else that all had to be completed at once that the DNR gave you approval for, in which substantial sums of money were expended?
I guess the legislated shoreline would be the only other aspect of that.
So what kind of shoreline?
Legislated shoreline, basically a concrete wall that defines where the shoreline will go.
Were you able to build a concrete wall on the entire shoreline?
That's correct, until the point of there was a dispute in 1977 about the DNR said that the shoreline is the high water mark. RW Docks thought it was the natural shoreline, and that's when they decided, well, you need to build this quay in order to have a foundation for Docks 4 and 5. And RW Docks said that was reasonable, so they did build the quay at that point.
What's a quay?
A quay is, it's shown in the materials, but it's a concrete structure that's placed on the bed of the water, and then it's filled in with dirt in this case.
I was thinking of quay. Okay, so how much money was expended for all of this?
I believe it's around $2 million. So, getting back to the trial court and the rational or the lack of rational process that was applied in granting summary judgment, the trial court should have decided, is there a total deprivation of all of Bob Holmgren's or RW Docks investments? And if it concluded that there was, it would be a categorical taking under the Lucas standard. If it concluded that it isn't a deprivation of all economic use of the property, which it apparently did, then it needs to decide, well, why not? Is it because it did not take all of the property as a whole, or is it because 201 slips were built of 272 and there's some value in the 201 slips? It never made that analysis, and that analysis, I believe, is required by the Lovelady standard and by the Palazzolo standard, which is currently on cert to the U.S. Supreme Court on that very same issue. The trial court never did this analysis. Assuming even then that it had, and it concluded that we're going to analyze the property as a partial taking, that is, the whole marina is 272 slips, he has 201. Did the refusal to allow the 71 slips to be built result in the total deprivation of property? The court could have said no, it did not. But that does not end the inquiry, and in this case that did end the inquiry. But it should not have, because that is when the three standards set forth in Penn Central need to be analyzed, and those are the nature of the government action, the effect that the regulation had on the property owner, and also the reasonable investment-backed expectations. And I think what both the trial court and the Court of Appeals said is that if there is not an absolute deprivation of all economic use of the property, you can never have a takings. And that, I believe, is not correct. And for sure, this is still a developing area of law, but I believe it's founded in Lucas, and a careful reading of Lucas will certainly show that the Supreme Court never said that you have to have a total deprivation of property value. It said that a total deprivation of property value will be a takings.
What did you say will be a taking when it's less than full deprivation?
It's as the court said in Penn Central, each case has its own nuances and it has to be based upon a factual inquiry on an ad hoc basis.
You've got to have some sort of standard anyway.
Well, the standard, that analysis has to be done within the context of what was the government, the nature of the government action, what effect did it have on the property owner, and what were the reasonable investment-backed expectations. And
so here, what was the nature of the taking, that they refused to give you a permit?
The nature of the government action in this case, I think, has to be looked at as a whole. One, the DNR, or the state, knew the scope of the project to begin with. They granted all the necessary permits to build all of this infrastructure to the tune of $1 million, $2 million, or perhaps more. And at the last moment, when one more dredging permit was needed to complete the project, they denied the permit because weeds had grown as a result of the sheltering effect of the breakwater.
Is that a factual issue, whether the weeds were there before the weeds came afterwards?
I believe it's a factual issue. Certainly the administrative law judge in earlier proceedings concluded that it was in fact true that these weeds would not have grown except for the sheltering effect of the breakwater.
I thought, somewhere, I may be mistaken, but I thought that the administrative law judge, if I can find it here, indicated that while the breakwater facilitated the expansion of the weed bed and aquatic vegetation predated the marina development. Is that incorrect?
There was aquatic vegetation in the area, but it was not in the area of the breakwater. And it was not this rare emergent weed bed that was allowed to grow as a result of the breakwater. So yes, there was aquatic vegetation. Naturally, there would be in a lake. But it was not of the extent that it is today. And the way that it got to be the way that it is today is a result of the breakwater, none other. And first, I think the administrative law judge decided that. Second, it certainly is something that should be decided not on summary judgment, but after a full trial on the matter.
But don't we have to give a deference to the finding of fact of the administrative law judge?
I agree. And if we do give that deference, I think that RW Docs would prevail on that issue, that the weeds grew in this area as a result of the breakwater, and it's for this reason that the permit was denied.
Let's go. The nature of the government action here was that it didn't give a permit, and that you were saying that it didn't give it at the last minute, and that, so the effect was what?
The effect was that RW Docs invested approximately $2 million with the hope of making a profit after selling 272 boat slips. At this time, it's lost approximately $1 million or $1.5 million, and the remaining slips have a value of approximately $1 million to $1.5 million.
It's not going to make much profit anyway.
There may be a profit to be made, but certainly there would not be the loss to be incurred. So there certainly is, I think, the second step, the effect of the regulation on the property owner is definitely recognize in this case, we're talking $1 million or $500,000.
Could I ask you a factual question?
Yes.
Was the breakwater constructed before the docks were built?
That's correct.
You have to have a breakwater for the docks?
Absolutely. If there's no breakwater, you cannot safely moor deep water sailboats.
What did the breakwater cost?
I don't know what the breakwater cost.
Doesn't the breakwater benefit all of the docks that exist?
Yes, it does.
Would the breakwater have been smaller if there weren't that many docks?
It probably would have been.
Look at the picture. Might not have been.
If the breakwater preceded the docks, what is the evidence that government authorities said, you go forward with the breakwater, you'll get 272 docks, 272 slips?
Evidence is in the condominium declaration, which lays out the exact location of each of the 272 slips, and also the plans that were initially drawn up by RW Docks when the permits were initially granted.
Did you need a permit for the construction of the condominiums?
No, I don't. Well, I don't think you needed one from the DNR. Again, all these questions.
How many condos are up now? 271 or 201?
201 have been built. And
that means each one has a dock. In other words, understand.
Each one has a slip. That's right.
You have a dock and then you have a slip. Right.
That's correct.
Counsel, it seems to me that a point of departure is the threshold question in this case. To be advocating that the threshold question is the three tests of Penn Central, the three-prong test of Penn Central. Yet there's an argument that the threshold question is whether or not taking law requires that you consider the property as a whole. If you consider the property as a whole and find that, yeah, there still is use of the 201 documents, then you don't get to the three, then one, your opposing counsel, I think, would suggest, you don't get to the three-part test. Your opposing counsel, as I understand it, would start with the threshold question of, do you look at it as a whole or as a part? In fact, that's what the Court of Appeals did, and that's what they addressed first, the whole or part. And they don't really get to the three-prong test because they see that as the threshold question. You see the threshold question, as I understand it from your brief, page 31. The threshold thing is the three-part test.
I don't think that's exactly how I meant to say it if I did. The threshold question is, if there is a full taking of all economic value, then you do not get to the three-factor test.
Let me just, page 31, you say, the trial court never addressed the threshold question of, one, the character of the governmental action, two, the economic impact, and three, the extent to which regulation interferes with the investment back expectation. That's not the threshold.
It's the question that's asked after the trial court decides that this is not a full deprivation of all economic use. If it decides that this is a partial taking situation, then the threshold question is, how does this taking fit in with those three prongs? And certainly the court never made that question because it never got to the other question of, are we going to look at this as a taking of 71 individual condominium units, or is this a taking of only 71 of 272?
I think in your brief in chief you only cite the Seeley case once. How do you get around the Seeley case, if I recall it standing for the proposition that you have to look at the property as a whole and not in discrete pieces?
think the court in Zeeley said that the Lovelady's analysis, while only persuasive, is not going to be applied in Zeeley because we are not dealing with that sort of situation. So I don't think Zeeley actually said you have to have a total deprivation of property. Like Lucas, Justice Scalia and Lucas said that here we have a categorical taking because all economic value is denied. We need to go no further. It was the same in Zeeley. All economic value was denied or not denied. We don't need to go any further because we don't have a question like the one that we had in Lovelady's where parts were subdivided off at later periods in time. So I don't think Zeeley precluded the Lovelady's analysis.
Just so I will correct that quickly, in the latest permitting action between yourself and the DNR, they were, they being your opposing counsel or the DNR, was willing to let you have a partial. You want to dredge out 15,000 and then they said you could do 5. Am I mistaken as far as they were going to give you more slips, but not as many as you wanted, correct, in this latest increment of 71? How many more slips were they going to give you?
Those are part of the 201 okay, that are built.
All right. So that's part of that. So really you're arguing over the 71 total.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. I see my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes. Ms. Kroppenberg, Assistant Attorney General, arguing for
the DNR. May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kroppenberg, representing the defendants, respondents, the state of Wisconsin, and the DNR. In 1877, this court stated in Diedrich, at 42 Wiss, page 266, it is difficult to perceive how a riparian owner could take a right to intrude upon the public fee under the water, which he might not take to intrude upon the private fee bounding his estate upon the land side. It is precisely because the 1.5 docks that haven't been built and the right to place slips on those docks are not RW Docks' property, but the property of another, the state, that there is no taking claim here before this court. As Justice Wilcox noted, a riparian owner does have qualified riparian rights, as this court has stated in Black and Borman and the Court of Appeals in Cassidy. Those riparian rights include the exclusive right of access, the right to protect your shoreline from the action of the water, the right to place a pier out to a navigable depth so that you have access to the water. That right is in turn conditioned by the reasonable use part of the public trust doctrine. A riparian owner can place more than the reasonable use number of slips if, under Chapter NR 326 of the Administrative Code, they make those slips available to the public on an annual leasehold basis. Here, the RW Docks, as indicated in the declaration attached to their reply brief, they have platted Lake Superior and they have sold the state's water. The loss of income that they are claiming results from the DNR's decision in this case is money that they have no right to gain. It is illegal to sell the waters of the state.
But what about this, having sold the first 200?
Well, the DNR didn't know that they had done that until 1995 in the hearing.
Well, what did they think they were doing? Building 200 slips for their own use?
No, as a public marina, they thought they were being leased out, as slips are in almost every other marina in the state.
To anyone who comes along and pays the price.
Correct.
Was there a change? Opposing counsel mentioned, maybe I missed that, but didn't he, there was a change here to the document? Is that when it became private, or you always thought it was going to be a public facility?
According to the testimony in September 1995, the DNR had assumed it was a public marina until they were told that it was.
Yep, but again, that seems hard to fathom when public for, you mean that they would be, who would get the money for renting out the slips then?
The developer of the marina.
Right, well then it would never be, how would that be public? I mean, I guess what I'm distinguishing between, I could go up there and rent a slip, and what they've done now is what you're saying is no, that the slip goes with the particular condominium or, you know, assuming there's 201 of them there. That's the private part, but it goes with that.
Correct. That's correct, Your Honor. In Everly,
is the DNR going to have them remove these 201 slips?
Well, the DNR is waiting in part for the outcome of another documentium case. It's in the Court of Appeals now, but I suspect that as the court did in Gillen versus, as DNR did in Gillen versus Nina, it will exercise its prosecutorial discretion and probably work with the current owners. One option would be, rather than evicting them, to give them perhaps a life estate and then prevent and gradually turn what is a private marina right now into a public marina, but they haven't reached that yet.
Ms. Kloppenberg. I doubt whether anybody, including your opponent, takes issue with anything you've said to this point with respect to the law.
Okay.
Because that's very Hornbook law. That's pretty basic stuff. But as I hear the plaintiffs in this case, R.W. Docks, they seem to be making almost an equitable argument, as opposed to a legal argument. The equitable argument goes something like this. DNR, you knew when you first granted us the permit to build the breakwater and build the quay that this was for a project that was going to be for 272 units. And you sandbagged us, DNR, into expending money that and led us to reasonably expect that these permits would be granted. And then you pulled the rug out from underneath us when it came to the last dock and a half. How do you respond to that?
I agree that that's their argument. What they're really arguing is their estoppel argument, which they raised and lost and dropped without appealing. They're saying that because the DNR, the state, let us use part of its property, we, the state, now have to let R.W. Docks use it all. If the court accepts that, then once DNR says that you may have some piers, a riparian order come back and say, I want more, and the DNR will have to pay if it says, no, you can't have any more because of the public trust or statutory criteria. It puts DNR in the untenable position of either having to say no at the outset, which R.W. Docks has conceded would not have been a taking had they done that, or adhering to its legal obligations under Chapter 30 and the public trust to say yes where the public trust in Chapter 30 allow piers and then pay when a riparian comes back and says, well, now we want more.
Well, did the DNR know at the time that they granted R.W. Docks the right to construct that breakwater that it was the intention of R.W. Docks to build 271 slips?
It is not clear from the record what they knew, but it's not material, because in the very first contract or permit that they issued R.W. Docks, it was a letter, 1968, and it's in the appendix, I believe, to the respondent's brief, to R.W. Docks' brief, that they said there that this permit is for just the activity described here and does not indicate that any future construction, additional construction, will be permitted. Throughout,
that expressly stated.
Yes, it is. It is at the bottom of the page in the appendix. That's the 1968 letter to R.W. Docks. And then between then and 1972, DNR took some enforcement action because R.W. Docks proceeded in violation of Chapter 30. They agreed on what R.W. Docks could and couldn't do. DNR issued another permit in 1972 and again said that the activities that we're permitting here could be modified or may need to be removed if the public trust determines that that's the case. So at every point, the R.W. Docks was on notice that it could do what DNR was permitting it at the time, but circumstances could change and it could count on continued permits to develop develop until it was all done. So what DNR knew is not material. The contracts and permits in the record speak for themselves in terms of putting RW Docks on notice that its development was, would be subject to public trust limitations throughout the process.
Ms. Kloppenburg, maybe I misunderstood something that you said earlier, but I'd like to clarify it if I might. Am I correct in understanding that the DNR is opposed to this project, at least partially because of the fact that it's a condominium project rather than a public marina?
No, actually, Your Honor, although I think it would be, that's outside the scope of this case. The DNR denied the permit to build slips in the contract to dredge for the remaining 1.5 docks solely on the basis of its impact to water quality, to the lake resources, and to the safety of neighboring riparian owners.
So what you're telling me is that it wouldn't have made any difference if this particular project was for 71 more slips for a public marina?
Correct, Your Honor. It would not have made a difference in this case. Yes. I think some, to complete the Hornbook Law part, I think some analogies are instructive. In Eberle, Mr. Eberle was denied access to his property. Here, RW Docks wants to do something on the state's property. The state hasn't taken any of RW Docks' property. It's just decided not to give up some of its property. If Mr. Eberle had decided, in order to enhance his property's value, to go and build a four-lane highway on the state right-of-way, that's what RW Docks is asking to do now. If a property owner living next to a state park asked the state park to clear some trees so it could have a view of the lake because its property would be worth very much more, and say the park said, well, yeah, we can do that because that would help the forest and help our visitors, and then the property owner comes back, well, it would enhance my property even more if you just cleared the rest so I have an unfettered view of the lake, and the park said no, under RW Docks' theory, that property owner would be entitled to compensation. Or if that property owner had an inn next to a state park and asked the state park folks, said, I want to build a parking lot on the park for parking spaces for the people who use my inn. They can't do that, nor can RW Docks. Does it have any right to do what it has asked DNR to do in this case?
So your position is that the company doesn't have any property rights to the water. Therefore, by your denying a permit, they haven't lost any property rights, so they don't have to be paid.
Not only but that they don't even have a taking claim to make. Not that they aren't to be paid, but that there's no, they haven't stated a claim that would allow the court to apply taking law to
its
claim.
They have no property right, therefore your denial of a permit is not a taking, therefore no compensation.
Correct.
Is that your argument?
Yes, that is my principal argument, and I've exhausted it, so I will go on.
And your next argument is the argument advanced that was accepted by the Court of Appeals. Am I correct or not? I don't see the Court of Appeals deciding the case on your principal argument.
Not explicitly. The trial court judge did.
But not the Court of Appeals.
Right. The Court of Appeals went straight to the taking law analysis, and so will I. The question is, as some of the justices have stated, whether RW Docks has been deprived of all or substantially all practical use of its property. Only then did the court then go on to consider whether its reasonable investment-backed expectations and the background principles of state nuisance and property law defeat its claim.
Well, there isn't. There isn't any case, I mean, whether it's Lucas or Eberle, that would allow Eberle was not a riparian in the situation. Lucas was a riparian in one part of the sequence, but would allow a person to extend the riparian bed of the lake, other than I'm talking about that you could have a dock out there under Chapter 30 or what, I can't recall the exact statute, but this would be new and novel rather than allowing this extension. Am I wrong? Is there another case that site, right? But this would be unique in that sense.
Correct. I have not found any case either. The closest that comes is there was one old case that allowed a building to remain on the Rock River in Beloit because of previous court decisions that had let some other buildings stay there.
But that's a grandfather. I mean, we're talking
right.
about new construction or
Correct. Right.
dredging in one of the Great Lakes allow the construction of this facility.
Correct. There is no other case that has held what I believe RW Docs is asking this court to hold. In terms of taking law and what the rule is, this court in Seeley and Eberle and in Howell Plaza 1 said very clearly that a taking plaintiff must show that the regulation or regulatory action deprives it of all or substantially all practical use of its property. If the taking plaintiff can't make that showing, you stop and the plaintiff loses. The court that RW Docs says conjures up a different rule that, well, if you can't make that showing, then you go to the Penn Central factors is Florida Rock. Florida Rock was there when Seeley was decided, was there when Eberle was decided, and this court did not find Florida Rock compelling then. Florida Rock is also contrary to the U.S. Supreme Court cases, at least that part of it. The ultimate holding and the compensation that it allowed might not have violated taking law, but the way it got there was inconsistent with U.S. Supreme Court case law. All those cases that this court relied on in Seeley have all held that the definition of a regulatory taking is something that amounts to, that's tantamount to, total economic, the denial of all economic use.
Ms. Coffinworth, I know that the Court of Appeals said that this aspect of taking law, you look at the entire piece of property. But what was their basis for saying that? Because as I read in those cases, it seems to me that one could interpret them to say that what we do here in a case like this is you don't look at the entirety of the property, but you look at the property that's in question. And the property in question is this 1.5 docks. It's going to have 71 slips. And therefore, of course, their argument is, hey, this is an entire taking.
Well,
now why do we look at the property as a whole?
You look at the property as a whole because as was recognized in Seeley and the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court cases that Seeley cited, you will always have a total taking of the property that's restricted. And you need, way back in 1979, the U.S. Supreme Court in Andrews versus Allard said that the destruction of one part of one strand in the bundle of rights is not a taking. You must look at the property in the aggregate. And it is true that what the property in the aggregate is a factual decision in terms of how the property was acquired, the extent to which regulatory requirements varied as to different parts of the property, but you don't get there here because RW Docs identified its parcel as a whole from the very beginning. It sought a breakwater for a home marina. It made improvements on its riparian property for a home marina. The legislated shoreline that was discussed earlier was agreed to so that RW Docs could be a riparian owner and be entitled to build the marina. RW Docs always considered its marina as a whole, and therefore it's proper to look at the marina as a whole at this point. The reason why you not only look at the property as a whole, but you also consider only whether all or substantially all of the practical use and value of the property has been deprived, is that we're talking about the constitutional taking clauses that say no one's property will be taken without compensation. The economic result of a restriction must be akin to physical occupation. And Justice Scalia suggested in Lucas, it is like a physical appropriation to leave property economically idle. Justice White stated in U.S. versus Riverside Bayview Homes that the taking clause reaches only those extreme circumstances where regulations impose severe economic burdens analogous to direct physical appropriation. Regulatory taking law has evolved not into a flexible accommodation of interest, but to reach restrictions that to amount to virtual physical occupation. Therefore, when the U.S. Supreme Court and this court has found there to be a taking, it is either where there's been a physical occupation, a total denial of economic use, as in Lucas, or where a fundamental right of the property owner has been totally taken. For example, in Eberle, you had the right of access. In Hodel, you had the right to bequeath to your heirs. In Kaiser Aetna, you had the right to exclude others. Short of that, neither this court nor the U.S. Supreme Court has found there to be a regulatory taking.
I have to go back to the taking. Does this company still own land?
Well, according to its pleadings, it is the riparian owner. It owns all of the upland development in the marina and all the improvements on there.
So when you talk about taking, don't you have to throw in the land too?
Well, that's all there is, seems to me here. The land they have said is worth $2 million, and the improvements on that land is worth $8 million.
Yes, but now that's still worth something, even if you don't give them slips.
Right, they put in no evidence in the record that the value of that property would go down at all because of the denial of these last 70 slips.
I mean, that goes back to the first argument, what's the property? But if you're looking at the property as the whole, or even if you're looking at part of the property, you still have that land, you still have construction of apartment units, living units, I assume.
That's right.
Even if you don't give them any of the dock space, all it did would reduce that.
That's correct. There's right. They put in no evidence that limiting their marina to 201 slips would lower the value of their riparian property in any way.
They don't have any rights to that water or anything without the rights on land, right? They could separate those out.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, suppose you own the land. Can somebody sell the riparian rights to somebody else without the land?
No.
See, I'm going to keep the apartment units, build the docks if you can get a permit. Can you do that?
No, no one, state or private, can sell state waters to anybody.
Okay, so if you're looking at the whole, you're looking at all these apartment units.
Correct.
They ever do, no one's made that argument.
No.
Waters are not property rights that can be transferred at all. They can't properly be characterized as property rights. They're really a right of reasonable use that attends because of the ownership of the upland, I think is what you referred to, the actual land. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But I assume when you buy a condo or buy condo 177 and that allows you to walk on that dock,
well, in this
that would be something that would be of value to that. Otherwise, what would people be interested in? I can't walk on the dock. I mean, it's a private dock.
Right. Well, in this other dockominium case that's before the Court of Appeals.
Well, I don't want to just do this one.
But you could do it. There are other ways you could do it. You could have the pier be a limited common interest to some parcel of upland riparian property. Here, it's the pier itself that is it's not a limited common interest. It's what you own as a condominium owner. And I should say that under the condominium law, 703.03, this isn't even allowed because condominiums are only allowed to be held or created by owners. And because no one can own the water, they can't create this condominium. But again, that is outside this case, although it buttresses the state's argument that what RW Docs sought here was not its to own or to sell.
I I ask you a factual question?
Sure.
I think Justice Babbage asked what a quay was, and the explanation was that this was something under the water, concrete under the water, or some firm foundation under the water. Is that right?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen it, but I understand that once the shoreline was legislated, RW Docks got permission to erect this structure that would enable it to anchor docks, I guess.
Would enable what?
To anchor docks from it, but I take that only from the record.
Well, let me ask you this. If I ask you for permission to build a quay, and you said, okay, what would you expect that I would do with that quay?
Well, what RW Docks did, they did build the fourth dock off that quay. I don't know if it's quay or quay. They built the fourth dock off of it, and they added about 60 slips to it, I think.
I'd like to build a quay that goes all the way to the end of the bench here. And you say, okay, we got a dock coming right out here. What do you suppose I'd be building a quay at the other end of the bench for?
Well, until you ask, we don't know. And even if we suspect that you're going to build piers, want to build piers over there, we have in our permit for the quay told you that what you're doing now is subject to the public trust, and what you may do in the future will remain subject to the public trust. And this is no guarantee that you will be able to do all that you want to do with it. The quay may have been necessary to protect all of the upland improvements that had been developed to service all of the docks. That's not in the record.
The public trust is the lake bed, is that not right?
That's right, the lake bed, and
Now the quay is on top of the lake bed.
The state's title is in the lake bed. The public trust extends also to the water. The public trust, as the Constitution says, all the navigable waters and the rivers and streams and lakes shall all be forever free to everyone. It speaks in terms of the water. And it's because of that forever free clause that the way that Wisconsin acquired, became a state, that the title to the beds of the lakes, it's a matter of state law in this state, that title goes to the state. The title to riparian owners of streams, they actually own to the middle of the stream, the stream bed, but even that ownership is qualified and subject to public trust limitations.
Public, meaning a person can walk down the stream and walk down the riparian ownership, that's free to walk.
Correct.
Is the test for taking the same as the test for variance?
Well, I just read a shoreline zoning brief from my unit today, and it occurred to me that the language is very similar. The test for a variance is that there shall be no, that you are not entitled to a variance if you have reasonable use of your property. I believe that they are not identical. Reasonableness is not a part of the taking rule. There's less room for flexibility in the taking rule, I believe. It's whether you have essentially all practical use of your property. And that can be measured in terms of value or in terms of use.
Taking is no feasible use.
No reasonable. Taking is no feasible use, you're saying?
Takings is no practical economic use. Takings,
right.
Law. That's how.
And I would think that that's a little more generous than saying no feasible use. I think no feasible use is the most restrictive. I don't think no practical economic use is quite that restrictive.
Earlier, in response to a question from either the chief or myself, you indicated that back in 1969, the DNR had written a letter and given them a warning that this was subject. Now, in your brief, I knew that I had recall it was on page 25. Is that what you are referring to?
Page 25.
bottom of 25.
Yes, and also it can be found in the appendix to the petitioner's brief at page 119. It's the letter from DNR dated December 30th, 1968. And at the bottom there it says, further, the granting of this dredging contract is not to be construed as an assurance that the application for a structure at this location will be granted. Just touching for a bit on this emergent rebed, I think the facts are very clear. At pages 103 to 105 of the respondent's appendix, that's from the ALJ's decision, they find that this valuable habitat existed in a pre-emergent state before the breakwater. There's no dispute that the breakwater facilitated its development to become emergent, but it's also not disputed that were RW docks to be allowed to continue with this latest development, that weed bed would be destroyed. So there is no dispute of material fact with respect to the weed bed. I have exhausted my arguments.
Of the property being subject to the public trust and thereby making anything that the DNR does possible to amount to a taking is not the proper legal standard. Anytime we have a taking, it's presumed that the government action is appropriate and that they have the ability to do it. The DNR did have the ability to do what it did. The question isn't whether it was proper to do what they did. The question is whether if the regulation was to such an extent that it would be recognized as a taking.
Well, what property that your client actually owned was taken?
His riparian right to access water deep enough to navigate in. The infrastructure, the quay,
what
the breakwater.
So I can clarify, do you have any citation you can give us that would allow a riparian, you're talking about a riparian right to have a deep water lagoon, I believe that's what you're talking about, right?
Access to deep water, yes, whether it's through a lagoon or a pier.
Well, do you have any citation for the court on that property interest that you are...
have a case that dredged up United States Chandler Dunbar Company. It's at 229 U.S. 70, and it's talking about what your riparian rights are.
That was 229 U.S. what, 70?
70. That's the certain page I'm referring to.
What's the name of the case?
U.S. v. Chandler, C-H-A-N-D-L-E-R, dash, Dunbar Company. And it says, they also have the right to access deep water and when not forbidden by public law, may construct for this purpose wharves, docks, and piers in the shallow water of the shore.
That seems to imply a right of access or use. That doesn't imply a right of ownership in the lake bed or water.
Well, the right of an ownership is not a prerequisite to having a taking under regulatory taking doctrine.
You don't have to own the property.
Well, he owns the riparian. He owns the property next to the water, which gives him the riparian right.
But he doesn't own the lake bed by virtue of having stuck some docks into it by permission of the state.
I agree. He does not own the lake bed.
So
what
he
owns,
have to own the property in order to claim a taking?
I don't believe you do, because it's the regulatory scheme that, as the court stated in Lucas, while the property may be regulated to a certain extent, if regulation goes too far, it will be recognized as a taking.
But that doesn't answer the question that I asked. The question that I asked is, don't you have to own the property that you're claiming the state has regulatorily taken before you can have a takings claim?
You have to own property, which RW Docks does. That property...
But your client does not own the lake bed.
I agree.
And that doesn't, that analysis doesn't change, that legal status doesn't change because your client has been permitted or granted permission to put up docks and quays or cays and breakwaters.
I think I can explain it. He owns the land next to the water.
Right, and he doesn't want to put up condominiums on the land. He wants to put up condominiums on the water, which he doesn't own.
As a part of all of his rights as a owner of that land, his bundle of sticks, he, in particular, has riparian rights. Those are property rights. And those riparian rights are subject to regulation. If the regulation goes too far, it can be a taking. And the question is, in this case, did it go too far?
But that still is, those riparian rights are rights of access and reasonable use. They are not rights of ownership of the land under the water.
The rights, I believe, are subject to limitation by the state. And in this case, his rights were to build a marina, as evidenced by the permits and the discussions and negotiations he had with the DNR.
Isn't it really the other way around, that the public trust doctrine is subject to the limitation of the riparian owner's right of access and reasonable use? You're saying it's the other way around. I don't think that's what the law is.
I did not understand your question. I'm sorry, and I see that.
Reporter, please read it back, because I don't think I can restate it. That's right. It's just another way of asking the previous questions.
Thank you,
thanks.
Mr. Whitley. Thank you, Mr. Lavender. That concludes our argument tonight.